Well, great to see you all, and happy Easter. Well, this morning, on this Easter, I thought maybe we could begin a conversation about survival. Some of us have survived the Lenten season, and so why don't we do this? Just turn to a neighbor and share with them something you've survived recently. All right, I'll give you a couple seconds. Go. So what's something we've survived? Anybody on this side? Something we've survived? Childbirth. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? What's something we've survived? Somebody on this side? Disappointment. That's good. Mm-hmm. What's something we've survived? Grad school. Yeah, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. Okay, is a loss of a friend? Yeah, good. Or a friend moving away. Yeah, that's good. So I was thinking through this, and over spring break, we were out at Zion National Park, and there's one particular hike called Angel's Landing. Has anyone ever hiked that? And so it's a pretty steep hike. It's not that long, but you kind of go all the way up. And so at the beginning of the hike, you start going through these switchbacks. I think I have a picture there. And then you get to the top and you see this ridge that you'll start cresting. And so this is us kind of walking our way up. And so what we had found out was the week before we were there, someone actually died on this hike. So don't go to that one yet. So is the video in there? Yeah. So this is what the hike is like. So check out the clip. All right, so you kind of get a feel for what the hike's like. The entire time I was hiking it, the thing that was going through my head, and I was actually saying this out loud, I can't believe this is allowed. Like, how are we allowed to do this? This is crazy. So at one point, we took a break, and then we were just kind of sitting there, drinking some water, and then you look off in the distance, and it kind of looks like these ants are kind of cresting the ridge. And after 30 seconds, like, the fear started becoming overwhelming. Like, I could feel the fear like creeping up, and I was like, "We got to keep moving. If I sit here for any longer, I'm not going to make it." And so you get to the top, and then that picture before was the relief of Joshua making it. And when you're up there, after you survive this hike, it feels like you survived death, and everything feels like you feel so alive. Like, everything feels so vivid because it feels like I almost died and then I made it, right? And then once you're there, you kind of acclimate, and then Joshua's sitting on the edge, and I was like, "Son, you probably shouldn't do that because that really scares me." And so on this morning, when we celebrate resurrection, you could say that celebrating resurrection is simply the survival of death. And perhaps the meaning of death and resurrection is to show us that this is the pattern of how this universe works. Things die so that new things can birth. And perhaps more importantly, death and resurrection is the way we mature and transform. And so for us to survive the death of perhaps our ego, the death of the way we control life, the way we think we're loving, and these things keep dying so we can be rebirthed in new ways to transform and to mature. And so this morning, I want us to maybe consider, what does that feel like then, surviving death? And in those moments, what can we cling on to as we're birthed into new ways of loving and a new life? And so the text we're going to be in this morning is the lectionary text, the Old Testament lectionary text. We're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 31. And so we'll have it on the screens, as is our custom. If you can read it to a neighbor, we'll walk through it. All right. And so Jeremiah is writing this to people that have been displaced. And when we're surviving death, I think often that's what it feels like. Things are disorienting and we're displaced. Mary Carr says it like this. He says, "If you live in the dark a long time and the sun comes out, you do not cross into it whistling. There's an initial uprush of relief at first, then for me anyway, a profound dislocation. My old assumptions about how the world works are buried, yet my new ones aren't yet operational. There's been a death of sorts, but without a few days in hell, no resurrection is possible. And so Jeremiah is writing to these people that have been displaced and things are disorienting. And then this is what he says. He says, at that time, says the Lord, I'll be the God of all the families of Israel. So this is my family. I'll see them as kids. I'll love them like my children, and they'll be my people. Thus says the Lord, the people who survived the sword, people who survived death, found grace in the wilderness. And when we're in those seasons where things are being removed and dying, it often feels like the wilderness, or the things that used to work stop working. The things that we were dependent on are suddenly taken away, and it feels like we're in the desert or the wilderness. And what Jeremiah says is when we're there, maybe in hindsight, we'll find that in those desert seasons, there's grace in it. And so for us, think about a time that was a desert season for you. Maybe it was relationally. Maybe vocationally. Maybe it's the loss of something. And when you think back on it, do you find that as hard as it was, you probably wouldn't have chose it, but in those seasons, it grew you in some way, matured you in some way? Thomas Merton says this, desert fathers believed that the wilderness had been created supremely valuable in the eyes of God because it had no value to men. The wasteland was the land that could never be wasted by men because it offered them nothing, nothing to attract them, nothing to exploit. I was thinking through this, and some of you might know the artist James Turrell. Yeah, and he's an artist that plays with light. He's got an installation up at UT. And I was there recently for the second time. And if you've never been, he kind of takes away the distraction of day-to-day life so that we can focus on light that's always present. And so here's a video that kind of explains what his installations are like.
A room designed by James Turrell, looking out through an oculus, a hole with no glass.
And the room itself is circular. The entranceway narrower at the top, wider at the bottom. The geometries of the space are very simple.
It feels so elemental. As we record this, it's 6 a.m. The James Turrell is activated only at dawn and dusk.
And as we sit here, the lights that are at the edge of where the stone meets the wall change color.
But it's not so much that the walls change color, but the color of the sky is therefore changed. So right now, I'm looking at this cool yellow-green, and the sky is the most intense, rich, vivid indigo.
Moments before, the walls were deep greenish-yellow, and what we saw through the oculus was a reddish gray. So here, time is an important subject, a very slow movement of sunrise, and then also the scale of time, the changing of the lights that Turrell has orchestrated for us.
So that kind of gives you an idea of what it's like. And so what he's doing is he's saying that light is always present, but we don't notice it because there's so many distractions. So he takes away all the distractions so we focus on the light, if that makes sense. And so I remember the first time we went to the one here at UT, and then my younger son, Noah, after 30 seconds, he was like, this is just a hole in the wall. Let's go, right? And we're like, just wait. So he's sitting there, and then as the sun starts setting, the colors start being projected onto the ceiling. And then as the colors are projected on the ceiling, the color of the sky changes. And I could tell there was this one moment where his mind was just blown. He looks at the sky, and then he runs outside, and then he runs back in, and then runs outside, and he's like, whoa, this is crazy, right? And so there's another video that I'm going to show where James Turrell explains why he thinks this is important. So he's playing with light. But to him, there's like a deeper meaning behind it. So check out the clip.
The idea began to evolve so that I actually was making these spaces outside that you actually entered to then look out from, as opposed to gain outlook or even insight on how we perceive sky. this is a space where I want to bring the space of the sky down to the top of the space you're in, so that you really feel to be at the bottom of the ocean of air. And you really then experience this quality that can happen at the change of day to night and night to day. But doing this right at the cusp of change was very important. You could be not only looking at a painting or a work of art, but you're actually looking at yourself perceiving. This world that we have around us is not a world that we receive, but more a world that we create and make. Now, this seems a bit of a surprise because we really feel, and we are very much attached to the fact that we are receiving these perceptions as opposed to creating them. But we do create the reality in which we live.
So what he says then is the removal allows focus, but the focus isn't just on light that's always present. But he says the focus is so that you can see the way you see things. Does that make sense? That what we see isn't something we're receiving. What we see is something we're creating. And I wonder if those seasons of wilderness or desert are just the removal of the things we're dependent on. And I wonder if the grace in the wilderness is so we can learn how to see what we're seeing. Does that make sense? And so Jesus says it like this. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is healthy, if you can actually see what you're seeing, if you're perceiving it in a healthy way, your body will be full of light. Your life will be full of light. But if your eye is unhealthy, if you can't see how you're seeing things, then the world just looks like darkness to you. Does that make sense? You guys following? So let me explain this. So for the last 2 years, Karen and I, we've been married 18 years now. And I would say the last 2 years, the things that we did for 18 years just stopped working. And it was really disorienting. And it was kind of these things we were dependent on in the way we were interacting with each other were taken away. And so it was really disorienting. And then the last 2 years, we've done a lot of work. And so we've gone to a therapist. We're kind of working on, you know, our relationship. And I would say in that removal, as disorienting as it was, the one thing we learned was just the same thing over and over again. What we learned was how to see what we're seeing. We couldn't see it before, then we were projecting it onto each other, and then we just stab each other with it. Does that make sense? And the one thing that we've learned is like, oh, it's not really your fault. It feels like it's your fault. I just can't see what I'm seeing, and I'm putting it on you. Does that make sense? And so for us, I wonder in those seasons of desert or wilderness, maybe there's a part of our life right now that feels like that. I wonder, instead of blaming, instead of saying, if this could change, if that could change, what if we ask the question, what does this feel like? What am I seeing? And how is this showing me how to see? Does that make sense? And so Jeremiah is writing to these people who are displaced, disoriented. And he said, maybe when you look back in that wilderness as you're wandering, maybe you'll find that there was grace in it. There was grace along the way. Then he keeps going and he says this, the Lord appeared to him far away. And then he says, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I've continued my faithfulness to you. So he's saying in those desert seasons, it probably feels like God's absent. But in hindsight, maybe you'll find that God has always been loving, that he's always been present. And it wasn't that God changed, but we matured into our ability to receive God's love. Does that make sense? So maybe I'll ask this question. Have you ever changed your mind about someone and you realize that person didn't change? It was you who changed? So let me give you an example. So my son Joshua just started driving. And so he got his driver's license last week. And I remember, so we got his license and then he drove home and dropped me off. And as a parent, it's super surreal to get dropped off by your son and then just to see him like drive off. I was like, goodbye. Farewell. And as he was driving off, this memory of when I first got my license came to mind. I haven't thought about it in 30 years. And so when I first got my license, I decided I'd wash the car because I have a car now. And then I decided I'd wash both our family's cars. So we had a two-car garage. I remember pulling the first car out, no problem. And then the second car, I'm not sure why I decided to do this. I decided to put a little extra juice in it because that's what you do. And so what I didn't realize as I'm pulling out of the garage really fast, that it wasn't straight. So in one push of the gas pedal, I hit one car into the other car, and it cost my parents $5,000. One push. I remember I was terrified. I remember I was like, oh my gosh, my parents are going to take away my driver's license. They're going to be so mad. I'm going to be grounded. And then going in with my tail between my legs, I sit my parents down. I have something to tell you. And then I tell them what happened. And they didn't get mad. I remember them just taking a deep breath. They're like, okay, son, I'm glad that you're okay. And sometimes we need to learn these lessons. I'm glad it wasn't out on the road and it's fine. And I remember as a 16-year-old, I was like, all right, that's cool. And I drove off. And it took me 30 years to understand how loving and gracious that was. And in that story, my parents' love hasn't changed. They've always been that loving. But my capacity to love changed because I have a son. And now I can fully receive that love. Do you ever read the scriptures and it feels like God changes? It does feel like that. It kind of feels like there's the Old Testament God who's the bad cop, right? And then there's the New Testament God where he suddenly changes and like really kind and nice. You're like, what's going on? And I propose that what's happening isn't that God's changing, but that perhaps the scriptures are a development of human consciousness. And as our understanding of who we are and who God is, then we can fully more receive his love. Does that make sense? And so theologians say this, death or resurrection, Easter, do you know what the meaning of that is? It's not so that God will change his mind about us, which is what I thought, right? I was told that I was such a bad person that God had to kill his son so he could love me. But what theologians say is, no, it's the opposite. Death and resurrection, Christ on the cross, it's not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice. That death and resurrection is to change our mind about God. God has always been loving. His love doesn't change. He's always been faithful. There's a Catholic theologian, his name is James Allison, and he says in that act, he's trying to change our mind about God, and it changes the entirety of how we read the scriptures. So he tells one specific story. It's the story of Joshua and Achan. So Joshua is a military leader. And so his understanding of God, so he's winning the war, so he's telling it from his perspective. And so in his mind, if God is real, then he has to occupy other nations, like manifest destiny. And so he's winning battles, and then they're coming off of a battle that they've just won, and they're thrilled about it. And then their next battle they go into, they're a little extra cocky, and then they lose. But in the story, if God is on your side, you have to win all the battles. And so he, instead of taking the blame, finds a scapegoat, and his name's Achan. And James Allison says, I propose if Josh was telling this story, it's possible that he might have planted it. And he needs to rally the troops and rally the nation. And so he needs to blame it on somebody. And then James Allison says this, is it possible that in our telling of the story where we think God needs to act a certain way, all along in the scriptures, God's inserting himself in the story. And he says, who do we think is the Christ figure in the story then? He says, is it possible it's the silent victim and it's Achan? Does that make sense? And so for us, how do we feel about God? Are we changing in our understanding of his love? And as we grow in our capacity to love, perhaps it expands our capacity to receive love. James Allison says this, then perhaps our task then is we become revisionist historians. This is what he says. He says, we revise our story as we go along. And if we didn't, we would be less truthful, not more truthful. He says, often the stories we tell are stories of our pain and trauma. And that's what's winning. And we're telling our history from that. What he says is, because someone whose sins are being forgiven is someone who is being let go of being tied to their past in a certain way and being given a whole new perspective from which to hold themselves in relation to their past. In other words, a massive and often initially painful revision of their story is being given them by someone else. This revision is not, however, the enemy of truthfulness. It is because we are revisionist historians that we were able to become truthful. And what would it look like to continue to retell our stories from the perspective of God's love rather than our own pain and our trauma? All right, and then we'll finish up. Then he says, again, I will build you, and you shall be built, O Virgin Israel. So we can start again. We can try again. It's like a metaphor for new beginnings, that we can do it again and again, and there's new starts, a new beginning. And then you should celebrate. Again, you should take your tambourines and go forth in the dance of the merrymakers. Again, you shall plant vineyards. So you'll do something that you've done before, but you'll do it in a new way. Does it make sense? You've planted before, but now that you've survived death, you'll plant in a new way. On the mountains of Samaria, the planters shall plant and enjoy the fruit. And so what he's saying here, we might do the same thing, but maybe we'll do it in a new way now that we've experienced resurrection. Or some theologians say this, love isn't what you do, it's how you do it. So you might do the same thing, but the energy by which you do it is love. So I was trying to think of an example of this. So I'm going to tell another story of Joshua. So when he was young, we were hanging out at my in-laws, and they used to own this warehouse. They ran a hardware store, and they lived on top. And one afternoon, my wife was out with her mother, and it was just the two of us. And he was just crawling. He couldn't walk yet. And I remember just sitting there, just kind of hanging out, and you're a little bit sleep-deprived because you got a young toddler. And then I looked over at him, and he was looking up at me like, you know, Dad, I love you, those bright eyes. And then I saw something in his mouth, and I looked more carefully, and it was moving. And I remember I went down, and you do the sweep. You kind of sweep their mouth, and then out comes a cockroach, a live cockroach. So in that moment, I looked at him, threw away the cockroach, and then I just held him. I was just like, okay, hopefully this doesn't do permanent damage. Your mother does not need to know. I didn't tell my wife for 10 years. I told her 10 years later. And in that moment, anyone else who ate a cockroach, I'd probably just run, right? An adult, anybody else, I'd just run. But because he was my son, that energy between us, does it make sense? Yeah. Okay. I don't know if this is a great example. I was trying to think of a better example. It's a memorable example. But the point here is this. The energy by which we interact with someone, not the action, is love. And what Jeremiah is saying is you shall plant again. You can try this again. The good news is you don't have to do more. But when you do what you've been doing, will you do it with love? And so for us this morning, as we celebrate surviving death, will we go back into our world, into our lives, and do it with love? And so this is my prayer for us this morning. Oh, let me fall as grain to the good earth and die away from all dry separation. Die to my soul self and find new birth. Within that very death, a dark fruition. Deep in this crowded underground to learn the earthy otherness of every other, to know that nothing is achieved alone, but only where these other fallen gather. If I bear fruit, and break through to the bright air, then fall upon me with your freeing veil, to shuck this husk and leave me sheer and clear, as heaven handled Hopkins, that my fall may be more fruitful in my autumn sill, a golden evening where your barns are full. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.